Well, today on Issues Etc., we're going to be doing what we do best, that is, a little bit of everything. Regular listeners will note that this happens on a regular basis here on the program. We will take you from the extremes of Mormon theology here in the first 25 minutes of the program. We'll be talking in the second 25 minutes about questions that you might be asking the unbeliever. Usually the Christian finds himself on the answering end of the interrogation, and that's a good place to be, of course. But there are also questions that you can pose to the unbeliever. We'll be talking about that in the second 25 minutes of the program. Tim Dahlstrom, author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled The Power of Questions, will be our guest there in the second 25 minutes. The second hour of the program, does the Bible require you to spank your children? Or, to put it in more general terms, does the Bible require Christian parents to exercise corporal punishment, whether that be spanking or some other form of corporal punishment? That question is for you, and I'd like your answer to it in the second hour of Issues Etc., which will be open lines for your questions and your comments, and the number in advance so you know that also for this first hour as well, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I had mentioned, some weeks ago during open lines, as just an offhand comment, that my wife and I, as a general policy, do not spank our children. I don't have anything against spanking, and my children have been spanked from time to time, but as a general policy, we don't spank our children as a means of discipline. And someone called in and said that pretty much shot my credibility with him. So I thought, that's a great question for open lines. Does the Bible require that we spank our kids? We'll be talking about that in the second hour. Then, in the third hour of the program, Karen Malik will join us from the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer. We'll be talking about a new link that has been discovered in a report of the British Journal of Cancer between breast cancer and abortion. And then, Phyllis Schlafly joins us in the last 25 minutes of the program, president of Eagle Forum, to talk about the Federal Marriage Amendment and judicial activism. That's the lineup for today's Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before we get started, our Issues Etc. book of the month for July is a must-read, especially around this Independence Day holiday. And of course, the summer kind of turns into a long Independence Day holiday, doesn't it? Especially nowadays. We're coming up on presidential elections. You're going to be exercising your freedom and your right to vote in the next couple of months. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for July is called Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview, by a regular guest here on Issues Etc., Dr. Gene Edward Veith. Now, fascism might have disappeared in Europe, at least in its institutional form, around World War II, but it still exists, and its elements are still at play, both in our society and others, and there is that thing called Islamofascism. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for July is called Modern Fascism by Dr. Gene Edward Veith. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours to order the book. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website and browse before you buy, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section, find the book, Modern Fascism. It's our Issues Etc. book of the month for July. Eric Johnson joins us here in the first 25 minutes of the program. We're going to talk about an Arizona-based polygamist group. It also has its roots in Mormon theology. Eric Johnson is an associate with Mormonism Research Ministry. He's co-author of the book, and this is a great book. I have to recommend it because I've used it on numerous occasions for my own personal study and also in dealing with Mormons who come to my door. The book is called Mormonism 101, and he's author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Trouble Brewing in Controversial Polygamist Group. Eric, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
First of all, let's see if we can distinguish this group we're going to be talking about and its leader and their methods, their teachings, from mainstream LDS, Latter-day Saint, Mormon teaching and practice.
Well, this church actually has been around since the 1930s. It's an offbreak from the Mormon Church, of course. In 1890, when the church had its manifesto where it declared that polygamy was no longer going to be practiced in the church, a number of people rebelled at that. And so there were a number of splinter groups, and you can trace this group back to the 1890 time. And so this church, along with all polygamous groups that would be in the Utah area and in the West here, would hold to Joseph Smith Jr., Brigham Young, and John Taylor, all three of those men who practiced and preached polygamy. And it wasn't until the fourth president came and had the manifesto that they stopped polygamy. So this group has been around probably longer than any other group, and actually it is the largest group. There are probably anywhere, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 30,000 to 60,000 polygamists in the Utah area, and this church has somewhere in the 5,000 just in the two cities of Colorado City, which is in Arizona, and then across the border is Hilldale, which is in Utah.
Now, as a matter of history, why did the LDS Church, its main branch, why did it abandon the practice of polygamy?
It was under a lot of pressure from the federal government, and the federal government was on their case since 1852 when they found out that the Mormons were practicing polygamy, caused all kinds of problems, and they made Utah a territory in 1850. And they pressured Brigham Young for years, and he never gave in. And then they put together several laws. To make a long story short, they basically said, if you don't accept the law of the land, we're going to come in and swipe you off the face of the earth. If you accept this, we'll make you a state, which is what the Mormons were hoping for, to make Utah into a state, and actually occurred 6 years after the manifesto in 1896. So, it was a lot of pressure, and it's interesting because there's a book, and there's a few books that are really good reading if people are interested in the subject of Mormon polygamy, but one of the best is by a Mormon historian. His name is Richard S. Von Wagner, and his book is called Mormon Polygamy, A History, and he's a Mormon and a graduate of Brigham Young and currently lives in Utah, but he clearly shows that Mormon leaders continued to practice polygamy all the way until 1906. They continued to marry people in the temple secretly, even though it was against their own rules as well as the rules of the land, and it wasn't until 1905 that the clamps were put down, and it pretty much ended in 1906.
What theological reasons did the LDS Church give? I know that you've outlined kind of the political reasons, the practical reasons why they did. What theological justification did they have for abandoning polygamy when it was not only the actual practice, but also the stated teaching of the church up until that point?
And that's exactly what Warren Jeffs and other polygamists would point to. Your question is a good question. Why did they get rid of something that's still in the D&C? The Doctrine and Covenants is one of the four scriptural books in Mormonism, and D&C 132 clearly says that polygamy was not to be abandoned. This was something to be practiced, and so polygamists would point to that question and say, we are doing what our original leaders have said, and they don't care what the law of the land says. It was never to be abolished. And it's very clear, if you go back into history and take a look at what Brigham Young said along with Joseph Smith, that these were eternal principles and should never have been eliminated. And the same thing would go for the issue of the blacks. A lot of Mormons are still upset. In 1978, when they went ahead and declared that blacks would now be able to hold the Mormon priesthood, that really infuriated people, because that was always the way it was supposed to be, that blacks would, in essence, I mean, Mormons don't normally like me saying this, but blacks were second-class citizens until 1978, when they were allowed the opportunity to go into the temple and receive the full rights that everyone else was able to receive.
Okay, let's talk about Warren Jeffs, the prophet of this Arizona-based group, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the FLDS. Tell us about its prophet and the most current news that's coming from this polygamous group.
Well, he's an interesting guy. He's an enigma for a lot of people, and really was kind of quiet for the years he's taken over since his dad died about 3 or 4 years ago. And there was a power struggle, actually, with a guy named Louis Jessup Barlow, and he just died, actually, just last month. He was 79 years old. He was able to win a power struggle and take over the church. He's a former principal of a school there in that area of the Colorado City area, which is in northwestern Arizona, not too far, I guess, from the Grand Canyon, and he's a pretty much a power guy that likes things done the way that he likes them. He ended up kicking out a couple of dozen members of his church, and it caused all kinds of problems because he was able to do that in the past in a little way, but having that many people, there were actually some who spoke out. One 35-year-old Ross Chatwin was very vocal and had the press over to his house and basically declared war on Warren Jeffs, which was unheard of because he was able to do whatever he wanted and nobody would ever question the prophet. And so it kind of opened up in the media a lot of what this church is all about. And so he kicked them out for whatever the reasons. He really didn't give many reasons. Ross Chatwin he kicked out because Ross Chatwin wanted to marry a 17-year-old, and he didn't want to have to go through the prophet to be able to do that. And so he kicked him out. And there were other reasons for other people. But don't think that these guys are moral themselves, because Warren Jeffs has several dozen wives, most likely up to 50, some have estimated. We don't know exactly. It's very secretive in this whole religion. And he actually has been charged with having sex with two minor wives of his own. And so he's not out there, just married to one. He's married to many. And actually, the rule of the religion is you have to be married to at least three in order to progress to heaven. And so he has the power to be able to tell people if they're going to be married and not married. And if he kicks you out of the church, not only can he take your wives away, but he can take away your property. Because the property, this is a fascinating thing. They live by what Brigham Young instituted back in the 1860s. It's called the Law of Consecration. And the Law of Consecration says everything you own is what we own. And so literally what they have done is all of their real estate, they actually own a real estate arm. And this real estate arm owns all of the houses that the people live in. So when they kick you out of the church, they're basically kicking you out of your home. They can take your wives and children and marry them off to another man, and they can take your homes. And this is what is happening. And so some of these guys are fighting that, saying that's not fair because we helped to build these homes and we put all this money into it. You can't just take that away. But legally, I mean, they signed the paperwork, and so it's been kind of an ingenious way that the church has been able to gather its power. And in addition, it depends on who you talk to, but Warren Jeffs recently, in the past year, put on kind of a tax on every male. And depending on who you talk to, again, there's no official website you can go to or a book necessarily, but anywhere from $500 to $1,000 a month, every male has to pay in addition to the regular tithe.
And the tithe is a strict 10% among Mormons, isn't it?
Absolutely, and they would hold to that, too.
Okay, so much to ask here. But first it occurs to me here, Eric, is this what Mormonism itself would look like today if it had continued on its original path according to the teachings of Joseph Smith and its first several successive prophets?
Wow, that's a great question. And, I've never been asked that one before. And I think it could look very similar. However, I just don't think it would have ever happened, and here's why. Because the Mormon church is into image. The current Mormon church, we're talking about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with 11 million members and its headquarters in Salt Lake City with a prophet they call Gordon Hinckley, who supposedly has the ability to be kind of God's representative here on earth along with his 12 apostles. They are so much into image that I think it would have eventually gotten changed. But if the question you raise, a what if, I think it's a very good likelihood, because this is very much what Mormonism looked like back in the late 1800s.
Now, let's talk about not only polygamy is the issue, of course, that brings the charges against Jeffs, the prophet of this fundamentalist Latter-day Saints church, but you also point out several ways in which this is a very secretive sect of Mormonism. Talk about its secretive isolationist tendencies.
Well, first off, Warren Jeffs, with at least 14 of his wives and probably more, we don't know how many, and his numerous children, live in the center of Hilldale, which is in Utah, in a city block-sized compound, and it's actually patrolled by armed guards and surrounded by 8-foot block walls. The guy that actually is with the federal government is looking into it right now, and he's never even seen Jeffs. He's been there for a while. They did, in a recent article, and I can't find this article in front of me, but I just thought about it. Just about a month ago, they've been doing research on the police department itself. The last 6 months, they've been since all of this news has been coming out, and more than half of the police officers are polygamists and actually have been giving information to Warren Jeffs that should not have been given. And so there's all kinds of, in Utah, there's a lot of concern, and yet they can't go in there and actually bring in a lot of police. They're really scared of a Waco-type thing happening. So they're trying to discover the information themselves. The federal authorities, the state authorities are trying to figure out, what do we do with this without making it into a situation, if you remember back in the 90s, the mid-90s, when we had that whole situation with Waco and the disaster that happened there. They're very scared. They're wondering how much, if they have munitions, if they have guns. There's different reports on what these guys have. What's fascinating is these guys are so secretive. It was just announced this past week, this is breaking news, that they're looking to move to Texas out of all places. And imagine the Texans are probably not too excited about this, but they're looking at going to the town of El Dorado, Texas. I don't even know where that is. It's in West Texas somewhere.
Yep.
And apparently they are buying a 1,600-acre ranch. And what they want to do is they've been constructing buildings on it, and they're expecting, and very soon, they're expecting 200 members to take up residence, and they're looking to possibly have many more. And there's a couple of thousand people in El Dorado, and this is what the sheriff says. He says, our biggest concern was that we wouldn't be dealing with another Waco problem here. We have talked to them about polygamous marriages and underage brides and made them very aware of Texas laws concerning sex with a minor. They told us they didn't plan on practicing that in this community. Well, I can tell you right now, that's a lie. And the people of El Dorado ought to be very concerned, because I think these people are looking to escape what really is a hornet's nest, and everybody's, you know, trying to exterminate them. I'm really surprised they're looking to go to Texas. A lot of people, myself included, thought maybe they would look to go to Mexico, where they could work deals out with the Mexican authorities and probably live in peace. But they have money. We know that they have lots of money. It's one of those things that, we just don't know very much, and it is very secretive, and they don't just give press conferences. And, in fact, trying to do this article I did for the Christian Research Journal, there was no way to get a hold of Jeff. In fact, Jeff, when the Associated Press asked to speak to him, their church attorney, his name is R. Scott Berry, claimed that was not part of Jeff's job description as a spiritual leader. So I don't know of anyone who has ever talked to Jeff as a prophet since he became a prophet.
Now, you point out in the story as well, and this kind of ties in with the moving to Texas, the quasi, or at least suspected quasi-military, militant nature of their organization. You mentioned that the current prophet's father, Rulon Jeffs, predicted, mm-hmm. I take it around the millennium, that his followers would be taken up to heaven. Do you know anything, or are there any indications of a kind of an apocalyptic mindset in this group?
You know, they weren't the only one that did that. In fact, I work with a group in Manti, Utah. It's a church that probably has about 200 or 300 members, nowhere close in size to this church of about 8,000. And in a lot of 1999 was a big year, because a lot of them were making those kinds of predictions. I'm not an expert on particular the FLDS and their apocalyptic ideas back in 1999, but the church that I was studying back then and knew and have contact with, they predicted that 1999, the fall, that Russia was going to come in, that there was going to be all kinds of things happening. Long story short, they would end up taking over. Jesus would come back to the world. I went back in 2000 and I talked to the president of the church. He gave me an interview on tape. It was fascinating, because I would think they'd be embarrassed. And when I asked about it, I said, how come this did not take place the way you said? And he says, who says it won't? And I asked him about that. I said, what do you mean, who says it won't happen? He says, well, it still could. I said, are you saying that possibly we could go backward in time? And he says, absolutely. He called it a wrinkle in time. And you can think of all the science fiction books that you've read. But basically, he literally said it would be fulfilled, maybe not in the future, but in the past. And so they changed the prophecy so that the prophet there was not going to be wrong. And in the same way, they have protected their prophet in what they said here. As far as future apocalyptic type things, there's no signs that they have been stressing that. In fact, last year, they pretty much suspended church services for a few months. They just kind of, for whatever the reason, weren't meeting regularly. And it's interesting how they decide how they're going to do things.
What is the current state? If you could characterize the current state of affairs in the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints Church, this polygamous group in Arizona, what would you say the state of affairs is there?
Well, fearful is probably what they're thinking, because, see, they've been protected for all of these years. If you remember your history, 1953, July 26, 1953, they had a series of raids on what is now Colorado City, where they're at, called the Short Creek Raids, and maybe some of your older listeners would remember that. It was actually on the front page of the New York Times, and it caused such a backlash that these children and wives were taken away from the husbands, and the husbands were thrown into jail for polygamy, that really polygamy had not been prosecuted by the federal or state authorities because of the backlash that received in 1953. Now, that lasted all the way until the Olympics in 2002, when they actually put to prison a guy named Tom Green. And maybe you saw Tom Green on some of the TV shows, 2020s and things like that, and he was talking about how he was a polygamist. Well, that kind of broke the baby's back here, because with Tom Green going to prison, now all of a sudden there was more of an idea that we can prosecute these guys. And so I think the fear that they have, and the reason they're thinking of moving, is they realize they continue living in the current state, which they believe to be, they would literally point to the Bible as well as the Book of Mormon to say that this is the way it should have been. But if they continue to live in the ways that they're doing it, and marrying underage women, and financial dealings that are, I mean, the way that they work the welfare system. See, they're not married in the church. When they get married polygamously, they get married, actually, they're married in the church, but not in the state's eyes. And so these women are all single moms, and they're getting welfare money. It's incredible the kind of money that goes into these towns and little they give back. And so you know, they continue doing these things. I think the federal and state authorities are pretty much fed up with this, especially since some of these girls are trying to escape, and they've been captured by the church and then taken to Idaho and other compounds that they have to be reprogrammed and then brought back, and they're fully being watched. And so if you were to go right now, if you were to walk into Hilldale or Colorado City, you would see the people that are there, because they're very distinctive in their clothing. They dress almost like Amish kind of people, and they would be watching you. And if you tried to talk to them, they would not talk back to you. They basically would just ignore you.
With only 30 seconds here before we have to wrap this up, Eric, what is the standing of this group with the Salt Lake Mormon Church?
Mormon Church has nothing to do with them, and so a Mormon listening to this needs to rest assured we're not saying that this is Mormonism at all, that the Mormon Church would also say this is the wrong thing to do. But these are people who do believe they're following the way Mormonism should be today, and that includes polygamy.
Eric Johnson, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Johnson is an associate with Mormonism Research Ministry. He has co-authored this excellent book called Mormonism 101. The website for Mormonism Research Ministry is mrm.org. mrm.org, Mormonism Research Ministry. He has authored an article in the latest Christian Research Journal titled Trouble Brewing in Controversial Polygamist Group. When we come back from this break, Tim Dahlstrom will join us. He's a former federal investigator, and he teaches critical thinking as an adjunct instructor at the University of Phoenix. We're going to be talking about questions for the unbeliever. Very often, the Christian finds himself on the answering end of an interrogation when they converse with unbelievers. What questions should you be asking the unbeliever as well? We'll talk about that after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The fascists of the 20th century have been dead for 60 years. But are their ideas, is their worldview still alive and well in the 21st century? How have the fascists' disregard for life, for truth, and for Orthodox Christianity survived into the postmodern era? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is called Modern Fascism, The Threat to the Judeo-Christian Worldview by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Gene Edward Veith. You can have Modern Fascism by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. Or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Modern Fascism. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
A little girl who lived in poverty and illness used to fight other girls who told her about Jesus Christ. This Global Minute highlights a miraculous change and urges you to pray for kids in India. Arti is a girl who grew up in a village where people worshiped many gods and goddesses. She came to the Ramabai Mukti Mission like so many girls who need to escape despair and poor health. Other girls of Mukti shared with her that Jesus is the only true God, and she fought with them. And then she slowly began to realize Christ's amazing truth. Arti now loves school and excels at memorizing Bible verses, so pray that she'll continue growing in her faith. Pray for other girls at Mukti to embrace Christ and become future leaders for Him in India. Read more about Arti and children like her in India. Request Arti's story by calling 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. You need to know the name of Jillian Humphreys. Jillian is being touted as an excellent candidate to become National Director of the Infant Adoption Awareness Training Program. In 35 or 40 years, let me explain. Jillian is a baby who has been given a gift beyond words, adoption into a loving family. People of faith should have a ready appreciation for adoption. To the Romans, St. Paul wrote that Christians have been grafted into the tree of God's people Israel. And to the Corinthians he wrote, "You are not your own, you were bought at a price." Different metaphors, but the same truth. To treasure being brought into something wonderful that wasn't ours by birth. Since abortion was made legal, people have paid less attention to adoption. Indeed, abortion counselors don't present adoption as a better alternative. Dr. Paul Devantier is the National Director of the Adoption Awareness Training Program. When attendees at a conference asked if the Adoption Awareness Program will continue, he held up baby Jillian and said he hoped she'd apply to be National Director and that the program will still be going strong. What a great gift Jillian has been given. Let's promote it for others as well. I'm Dale Meyer.
Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to tune in for a special live broadcast of Issues Etc. this Saturday night at 7 on AM 850 KFUO. We'll be discussing Islam with Dr. Alvin Schmidt of Illinois College. We'll also be talking to Dr. David Adams of Concordia Seminary about creationism. So tune in and call in Saturday, July the 10th from 7 to 9 for a special live broadcast of Issues Etc. right here on AM 850 KFUO. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in the middle of the first hour, we're going to be talking about questions for the unbeliever. Now, I think that Christians ought to take seriously the Bible passage. It talks about always being ready to give an answer for the hope that is in them. That's a large part of what we try to do here on Issues Etc. is equip the priesthood of all believers for giving the answer that is drawn from the hope that is in them, be it an apologetic answer, an answer, an evangelistic answer, or just an answer to the kind of questions you find out there in the public square, for which Christians have unique answers, of course, these questions. But the interrogation, if you will put it that way, in the best possible sense, can go both ways. What questions ought we be asking unbelievers? And what makes a good question? We're going to be talking about that during this 25 minutes of Issues, etc. Tim Dahlstrom is our guest. If you have a question or a comment for him, feel free to call us 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Tim Dahlstrom is a former federal investigator. He teaches critical thinking as an adjunct instructor at the University of Phoenix, and he is author of an article for the Christian Research Journal titled The Power of Questions. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on your show.
Happy to do it. What did your work as a federal investigator, what did it teach you about the importance of asking good questions?
Well, through training and a lot of experience, I came to realize that a question is not just for gathering information. Rather, questions stimulate people's thinking. They get people to open up. And they're persuasive. More importantly, they get people to persuade themselves. And certainly not least, they put you, the questioner, in control.
All right, then you advocate early on in your article that when presented with questions from unbelievers, the believer would do well at times, when it's appropriate, to follow Jesus' example and to answer with a question. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that we oftentimes think, when we engage the culture or speak with someone, that we have to have a statement or an argument, some type of answer in that regard. However, there is a lot of examples in the Bible. Certainly, Paul and Jesus regularly used questions in evangelism, apologetics, and teaching. And oftentimes it's worthy of us to ask a question in answer rather than simply giving an answer.
You also quote from Phil Johnson, who is a regular guest on this program. He has a tremendous book he just came out with last year, The Right Questions, very helpful. But there's this general principle from which Johnson works, which is if you ask the wrong question, you will likely, one might say inevitably, get a wrong answer. How do we figure out, when we're talking to the unbeliever, what the right questions are?
Well, mainly by asking a few questions of introduction and to feel your way around, so to speak. Asking a person's background and seeing where they're coming from gets you to a point where you can see what the issues are, and from there you can formulate a question which addresses that person's specific issue. And that's what Phil Johnson points out, is that once you get on that path where you're addressing the specific issue with questions, eventually that will lead you down to a path where the conclusion is almost foregone, so to speak.
Now, how is that different from what you warn against in the article, and that is asking a leading question? Tell us what a leading question is.
Well, a leading question is one that the question itself suggests or infers what the answer should be. And you hear these in the form of, don't you think, or wouldn't you agree, or shouldn't you, you know, X, Y, Z, whatever the question is. And we're not talking about that, but what we're talking about is asking questions that stimulate thinking and thereby get that person to persuade themselves so that they, of their own accord, pursue down a logical path to a conclusion or an understanding or a little bit of enlightenment.
Let's lay down some simple rules of thumb. What makes for a good question? And then we'll get more specific about asking good questions of unbelievers. What makes for a good question?
Okay. The KISS principle, keep it short and simple, is operative here. A question, first, it needs to be simple and confined to one topic. If you start asking questions that involve multiple issues, you'll simply get confusion. So the best thing is one topic and a very simple question. Second, a question has to be clear and easily understood to the person you're asking, and this is where you'll have to adjust your approach to that particular person. In 1 Corinthians 9, Paul says he tries to be everything to everyone, and that's the spirit we're talking about here. Speak to the person at whatever level they are as best you can. And then finally, your question shouldn't contain frightening or emotionally charged words. For example, I could tell my son, I could ask him, did you forget to do this? But I could also say, did you fail to do this? Well, that word fail has a bit of an emotional charge to it. And generally what you get in those situations is much more of a visceral response rather than a reasoned answer.
With regard to that third aspect of a good question, there are going to be times when Christians, when talking with unbelievers, are going to have to use emotionally the word, the name Jesus has a certain emotional charge with it. Words like sin also have an undeniable emotional charge and sometimes a frightening connotation, and they're very uncomfortable for people to hear, but Christians will have to bring those things up.
There's no question about that. And yes, just the word, the name Jesus itself invites some interesting reactions. Some of those words we might be able to change to a alternate description. And I don't mean change the actual meaning of the word, but just term it as something different, at least to start with. For instance, sin as an example, one might start by describing that as missing the mark or being imperfect. Now, subsequently, it would have to be developed into breaking God's law or something similar, which more fully communicates the biblical understanding of sin, but one can take a bit of the emotion out of it with an alternate description.
What about this central question that you get to later in the article, and that is the identity of Jesus himself? Jesus asks this question of his disciples. He even seems to be somewhat interested, maybe just for rhetorical effect, in what the crowds, who the crowds believe he is. Is this where it's all really driving in the end?
Well, absolutely. And Jesus, one could say that the eternity hangs on a question. And that's Jesus' question, who do you say that I am? In Matthew and Mark both record that. Now, that's a situation where you could lead up to that ultimate question with some other questions which would get you information, which would stimulate the person's thinking and get them to open up a little bit. For example, you might say, what do you say are Jesus' most important characteristics, since we can agree that Jesus is a historical figure? Then you also might say, how did Jesus describe himself? And that would give you an indication of really what that person knew about Jesus and knew about the biblical record of Jesus. You could ask simply, was he an actual historical person? And those are all very non-threatening, but they give you a lot of information and let you know where that person is coming from. And, of course, the ultimate question, do you believe Jesus is God? And that's a nice lead-up into that ultimate question, which Jesus said, who do you say that I am?
We're talking with Tim Dahlstrom. He's a former federal investigator. He teaches critical thinking as adjunct instructor at the University of Phoenix, and he has authored an article for the Christian Research Journal titled The Power of Questions. Your questions and comments are certainly welcome at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking about questions for the unbeliever. Here's an actual scenario that I found myself in on an airplane about a year ago. I was reading something in preparation, show prep, and since this is Christian radio, I was reading something that was very obviously of a Christian nature. The guy on the plane next to me, Tim, notices this. He says, why are you reading that? I said, I host a Christian radio program. He wanted to talk about religion. I'm amazed at how often people are very anxious to talk about religion. He said, you know, I find all religions fascinating. All the world religions fascinating. And I asked him, that's good. Do you find any of them true? And I got a blank stare and no answer. I don't think he'd ever even considered the question. What do you do when you get the blank stare? The question they've never heard and they're completely unequipped to answer.
Yes, absolutely. And that is a pretty formidable question, actually, because most people I find have not thought through these things and what they believe. And so something like that, by the way, a great way to get people to scatter on the airplane is to open the Bible and start reading it. They tend not to talk to you. You might reformulate that to say, well, let me ask you this. What are some of the differences in some of the religions that you've looked at and that you find interesting? That'll open him up a little bit and to see what really his level of knowledge is and what his perspective is. And then you might follow that up with, well, how does the beliefs that you have learned from these square with your experience in the world, or how do they compare in terms of their seeming validity for your life? Something like that. Backing off the big question a little bit and asking some things that he might be able to answer more. Because obviously, I would say it sounds like the person did not think through the whole thing to determine what was true or not.
I think the issue of truth was just simply, like you said, something he had not considered. Is that really one of the obstacles we face, at least in kind of the postmodern relative, there is no true, there is no false, there is no good, there is no evil culture that we live in, that people have not considered the issue of truth in the same way that Christians, we take for granted that truth is an objective reality?
Oh, clearly. In fact, it's one of the larger issues, I think, because it is in the final analysis that brings people to conclusions. And that's where questions can help, because postmodernism is inherently irrational or illogical. And asking some questions that stimulate thinking, that highlight some of the inconsistencies or the conflicts in people's views or beliefs, can move that person down the road to understanding that, yes, there is actually an objective truth, that it's not all relative, and can be used successfully in that way.
Here's the other scenario I was curious about, Tim. The runaround. Now, Christians are as guilty of this as anyone else. But it's the, when you ask me a question, I don't have an answer, I simply change the subject. Or I go off on a tangent, and there's no real Q and A taking place. It's just kind of Q and dodge, Q and another dodge. How do you deal with it?
Well, yes, I've had a lot of experience with that. but what you can do there is move from what we would call open-ended questions, which are those that ask for description or explanation, to closed-end questions, which are those that require a specific and sometimes predetermined answer. So rather than asking for an explanation, you ask a specific thing. As in my example before, was Jesus an actual historical figure? Now, that's really a yes or no question. If the person dances around, you can ask it again. No, what I really want to know is yes or no. And so you can pin them down to a particular answer by, one, being very specific in your closed-end questions, and then, two, asking the question again and even giving, here are the possible answers. Which one is yours?
We talk on a regular basis here on the program with Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason, and he has developed what he calls the Columbo tactic. When dialoguing with people on any subject, really just a kind of a general tactic, he calls it Columbo because of the television detective, who is always asking questions and always kind of in an unassuming, seemingly haphazard manner, leading toward, of course, he's going to pin the criminal. And he says it begins with, when someone makes a statement, asking, what do you mean by that? Is that a good question?
That's an excellent question, because what we get when we talk to people is a lot of verbiage, and oftentimes the words we don't understand, but the meaning behind what they're saying we don't understand. And Columbo does a wonderful thing. He assumes to know nothing. So he starts from ground zero in his questioning and works from there. And that way you will get the most information and the real understanding. Because if one comes into a conversation and begins to question, and the questioner assumes they know what that person is talking about, they're going to miss a lot. And to have the person explain it and even you read it back to them, so to speak, helps a great deal.
Another, the kind of second prong of the Columbo tactic is the question, where did you get that idea? What do you make of that?
That's a good one, because it says, what are your sources? What information do you really have? And you can work back from there. Because oftentimes people have an idea, but where they got the information, how good the information is, how consistent the logic is in the idea, is all up for grabs. And the way you can do that is by asking that question and getting down a little deeper into the person's reasoning, their assumptions, what's known, or what they think they know. So it's an excellent question.
So it sounds like good questions, good dialogue, and I try to avoid that because it sounds so pop psychology, but good dialogue between the believer and the unbeliever really needs to begin with the believer understanding the unbeliever and understanding what he takes seriously, what he considers to be true, trying to get it inside his head to a certain degree.
Oh, very definitely. And it's, I use a term in the article, I think, engaging the culture, and not confronting, but engaging. And we really need to do things with gentleness and respect. And part of that respect is saying, hey, I value you enough to let you tell me what you're thinking, what you're feeling, what your beliefs are. And rather than me assuming what I think they are based on whatever, the color of shirt you wear, or you know, who I size you up to be at first. And I think that's the measure of respect there. And it does engender people opening up.
Do you think that Christians, when, let's just put it in its kind of starkest terms, when they're in the public square and when they engage the culture, as you say, and unbelievers in the culture, do you think that they should initiate the conversation more often than they do?
Oh, I would certainly. I would love to see that. I myself do not initiate conversation as often as I should. Well, one way to do it is begin asking questions to get someone else talking and to find out where they're coming from. And at the proper point, you can put in your two cents, so to speak, and thereby get that conversation going sooner than you might otherwise, because it, people are sometimes hesitant to simply start talking or start preaching or something like that. And starting a conversation by asking a few questions is a great way to break the ice, so to speak, and to get those conversations going that otherwise wouldn't happen. And therefore, I think questioning is really a good tool, and it can be used successfully with a little practice.
I think that, and I'm imagining the listener who's been listening to our conversation, who says, you know, I just kind of walk around with this latent guilt all the time that I'm not out there engaging the person I see on the train platform, or starting the conversation with the person that I sit next to on the bus every morning or something like that. And I walk around this latent guilt, and I feel like I'm supposed to be some sort of covert spy, that every conversation I have with anyone should always have this kind of subtext or secretive mission to get them engaged and suddenly, you know, start doing apologetics or evangelism. What do you say to them?
Well, I would say if one has an interest in people and the ability to ask a simple question, you should be able to at least strike up a conversation and see where people are coming from. And if you get that track rolling, the rest should come fairly naturally, even though it's a bit scary. I mean, I certainly don't, I feel for people that have a guilt that may or may not be appropriate, but something like asking a question and really genuinely being interested in someone, that gets the ball rolling. And it's much like a semi-truck. If it's sitting there, you cannot turn it in any direction. But if it's rolling down the highway, you can turn it very easily in whatever direction you want. And being interested in people and asking a question or two will get that going. And hopefully, with that type of tactic, naturally, it will flow for you to speak how you feel led about the gospel, and to talk to people and hopefully relieve some of that guilt.
Someone says, Tim, I am afraid of having the tables turned on me. I think I understand what a good question is, but I'm a lot of smart people out there who could turn the tables on me and ask me a question for which I do not have the answer. Your best advice?
My best advice is to say I do not have the answer. I appreciate the question. And if it's a situation where you could get the answer for the person, let's say somebody at work who you see on a regular basis, say, hey, let me get back to you on that because I don't know. And it's fair to say I don't know. It's fair to say for the people whom you ask to say I don't know. But it also leaves an opportunity open to talk again. And that's a very good thing.
Tim Dahlstrom is author of an article for the Christian Research Journal titled The Power of Questions. Tim, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope everybody will be able to use questioning as a tool to engage the culture and be a little bit more effective in the work of the gospel.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
He's a former federal investigator and teaches critical thinking as adjunct professor at the University of Phoenix. Now, we're coming up here on Open Lines. Before we get to Open Lines, a special broadcast of Issues Etc. is coming up. Usually you won't hear this program on Saturday on AM 850 KFUO, but this coming Saturday from 7 until 9, a two-hour special broadcast of Issues Etc. right here on AM 850 KFUO. That's Saturday night from 7 until 9 o'clock. Our guest in the first hour, Dr. Alvin Schmidt. We're going to be talking to him about Islam. He is one of, I think, our listeners' favorite guests. They always respond very favorably when Dr. Schmidt is on. He's got a new book on Islam. He'll be bringing his expertise there to that first hour. And then in the second hour, that special Saturday evening broadcast from 7 until 9, Dr. David Adams. We're going to be talking with him about creationism here on AM 850 KFUO. We're going to be giving away books to the best callers. We encourage you both to listen and to call from 7 until 9 Saturday evening, this coming Saturday evening, here on AM 850 KFUO during that special broadcast of Issues Etc. Open Lines is next. Now, I asked it yesterday in advance of this hour, and I asked earlier today, does the Bible require you to spank your children? Corporal punishment. Now, the therapist and the psychologist will tell you that spanking, corporal punishment in the family is, most of them will say, passe. The teacher in the classroom where you send your kids might be shocked to hear that you at home administer corporal punishment to your children. Even the word punishment has taken on a very negative connotation. Now we talk about discipline. What does the Bible have to say about spanking your kids? I want your answer to that question on the other side of this break. It's an entire hour of Open Lines. Now I know that there are opinions and ideas and thoughts on this galore. I will reference again the fact that I brought this up as just an offhand comment in a previous hour of Open Line several weeks ago, that my wife and I, as a policy, do not spank our children. They have been spanked, of course, by us, but as a policy, we don't spank our kids. And someone called in and quite honestly said, look, that robs you of some of your credibility with me, that you don't you know the Bible passage? Spare the rod, spoil the child. Don't you know the Bible passage? The father who spares the rod hates his son. Well, we'll go through some of those Bible passages, and I'd like your answer to the question, what does the Bible have to say about spanking your kids, about corporal punishment? It's Open Lines next, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This break is an excellent time to call with your answer to that question. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then in the third hour, Phyllis Schlafly and Karen Malik. That's coming up next, Open Lines.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.